This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So we're at the near the bottom of this first page, where Indra asked the elder Subhuti. Subhuti is one of the Buddha's disciples, wise disciple, and Indra is the lord of the gods, kind of the king of the devas, a celestial being, kind of the ruler of the heavens. And so in the old Buddhist suttas, Indra and other devas, celestial beings, are often taking part in these assemblies and hearing the teaching of Prajnaparamita and sometimes when they think Buddha makes a really nice perfect wisdom statement, that Indra asks all the celestial beings to rain flowers down, things like this. So in this case, Indra in the heavens is having a conversation with the human realm. And also one of Indra's many names is Kaushika. And I think one text said something like his family name before he was a celestial being or something like that. But anyway, Kaushika is another name of Indra. And I appreciate that because Kaushika in Sanskrit means owl, which is one of my many names. And so Prabha Kaushika, it's a luminous owl, also called Kokyo. So here, Indra asks the Buddha's disciple, Elder Subhuti, great reverend, bodhisattva, mahasattvas, great beings, want to, here it says experience, but in the original it says, want to learn the profound, deep Prajnaparamita. How should they learn it? It's the same word. If they want to study Prajnaparamita, how should they study it? If they want to learn it, we could say if they want to experience it. In Japanese, gaku. If bodhisattva mahasattvas want to learn Prajnaparamita, how should they learn it? Subhuti said, Lord Indra of Kaushika, or Lord Indra, Kaushika, owl, if bodhisattva mahasattvas want to learn profound Prajnaparamita, they should study it as they would study empty space. They should learn it the way they would learn empty space. They should practice it or experience it as they would experience empty space. We've already been talking about that. You hear empty space, koku. It's that same ku that means emptiness. And ko also means like empty, but when they're combined, koku is like physical space, empty space. And then Dogen comments, thus studying prajna is empty space. empty space is studying prajna. And again, space is a wonderful metaphor for prajnaparamita because it's boundless. Space has no edges. It has no location. It has no location, and yet everywhere is its location. It sounds paradoxical, but we're talking about the space in this universe that is this universe, that holds this universe. It's not really paradoxical. It's no particular place, and yet it's every particular place.
Does it have contents?
It seems to have contents. I mean, if we're talking about the space in the room here, the space of the universe seems to be filled with stuff, including us. And that's kind of how prajnaparamita is. It's like empty space that seems to be filled with stuff, including feelings, perceptions, formations, forms, consciousnesses. All that stuff is appearing and manifesting in empty space of prajnaparamita. And just like all the zafus and the people are seeming to appear in the empty space of the room. And you can try to divide up empty space and partition it off by putting walls up in the zendo, but that doesn't really like change the space. And we say, well, there's the space in the zendo and the space out of the zendo. But if we look at this more deeply, we see it's just the same space with walls appearing in it. So if the prajnaparamita is like boundless, aware, knowing space, it seems to be divided and partitioned up by our individual bodies and even our individual consciousnesses. But those individual bodies and minds don't really divide up the space of prajnaparamita. It's not like you have a portion of prajnaparamita and I have a portion of prajnaparamita. It's all one indivisible prajnaparamita, but it's manifesting as each of us. So space is like a boundless and unlocated, and also space, physical space, doesn't change, right? It's always the same. You might say, well, but the there's more carbon in the air than there used to be even a few years ago. But that's just, we're talking about carbon, and even air, we're talking about oxygen. But space, like actual space, doesn't change. We could say part of the stuff in the space is carbon molecules and stardust or whatever else.
Could you say that you could study space by studying the relationships between the various contents in the space?
Hmm. So the question is, can we study space by studying the contents in the space, the relationship of the contents in the space? In a way, if we study the relationship of the contents really deeply, then we see really deeply, then we might see that the relationship of the stuff in the space is actually no separation, because the stuff in this space of prajnaparamita, the stuff that's appearing in prajnaparamita, is actually made out of prajnaparamita. So maybe we would say the space in the stuff appearing in the space of the Zendo, like the cushions, we say, are made out of kapok. At first, it looks like that, and fabric, and the people are made out of flesh and bones and so on. But from the perspective of Prajnaparamita, even all the stuff appearing right here is what it's really made of is the actual space, like knowing space, aware space, bright, radiant light of space. Now, how is it that we could say that these people, these bodies are made of this luminous space, this, of knowing, of premium, high octane knowing? Just that if we look for a body, in addition to the knowing of it, we can't find such a body. This is the, we have to look very carefully to, because first we might seem like we do find a body. Here it is. This is the body, but actually this is I can feel it. Therefore it must be a body, but the feeling is actually a mental event happening in the boundless space of awareness, right? Well, I can see the body, but the seeing is also a kind of knowing. I can hear the body, but hearing is also happening in this knowing space. We can't find any hearing other than the knowing of hearing. Or then we can't find any sound other than the knowing of sound. We can't find any sensations in the body other than the knowing of the sensations. So if we look carefully, it keeps coming back to this same point that we can't find anything other than knowing, and the knowing is empty space. That's why we can make these strange statements like all the stuff that's appearing in the room in its deepest nature is actually made of knowing space. Yes? Shoho asks, are you saying there's no object without a subject? Yeah, the teachings do say that, but there's no objects without a subject. And usually when we mean subject and in relationship to an object, then we think of like the perceiver, the experiencer, which creates an experience. But the experiencer, like me and you, when we look for them, we find that any idea of an experiencer is actually another experience. So the subject, I think we talked about this earlier, that the subject, when we look for carefully, we find it to be another object, actually. Any idea we have about a subject is another object. So these so-called subjects and objects are both appearing in this empty space. So the subject that's in relationship to an object is a kind of illusory manifestation of Prajnaparamita, and the object that's in arising in dependence on a subject is also an illusory manifestation of Prajnaparamita. And Prajnaparamita itself, it doesn't depend on anything. It's independent. That's why it doesn't arise and cease. Because everything that arises and ceases, like individual subjects and individual objects, are dependent, arise dependently, seem to arise dependently.
Sure, please, come on. So is there a difference between listening to me, I would be the subject, and you would be the objects listening to you as you're sounding on this text? Like the difference between when I'm not actually thinking of myself at all and I'm just completely in, like entranced, just listening, just experiencing that. Am I always like taking myself into account when I'm experiencing the subject? Or does that like color or change the way that I would experience like what you're telling me based on whether I'm like kind of thinking of myself at the same time or just like taking it in and processing the data that you're sharing?
Yeah, interesting. Like, so the question is like, if we're not particularly self-conscious, we might say, in the usual sense of self-conscious, like, I'm concerned about myself. I'm thinking that I'm a body over here and a mind over here listening. When we kind of forget about that, which does happen, we get really engrossed in something interesting or immersed in something. We kind of forget the subjective side. We lose ourselves in an activity. Right? And, so at that time, is there still a subject? Is that kind of like your question?
Yeah. Are you like is there a relationship between that kind of being in the zone and then Prajnaparamita? Are you more tapped into that or closer to the reality of things when you're just totally just taking it kind of on autopilot, not like thinking of, oh, I'm in this room in the Zendo with all these people.
Yeah.
I'm Zen.
I think so. I think it is getting, we call it the zone, right? It's often in the flow state. And I think that's one way of talking about what that, I would understand that to be like when we're not so self-conscious and we're just so, we're one with the activity. So we kind of forget ourselves. And I think that is true, that the sense of subjectivity, drops away, it diminishes more and more, maybe drops away completely. And therefore also the sense of objectivity. So it's not also diminishes. So we might say, well, aren't I just immersed in the object? I would say if at the time that we're in this flow and we're forgetting the subjectivity, it's not really like an object. What used to be an object is not really object. It's more like inconceivable, ungraspable unity. You could say subject and object collapse into each other, and it's just, and then we're talking about approaching, if not being, Prajnaparamita. I think that's right. Because Prajnaparamita doesn't mean, even though we're talking about it like empty space, it doesn't mean that nothing appears to be happening. It's very dynamic. It's not like nothingness. But that dynamism is free of subjects that depend on objects and objects that depend on subjects. Sometimes when we talk about this knowing space, it sounds like some sort of ultimate subject. And in a way, I mean, we could sort of talk about it that way, but usually the word subject is used in relationship to an object. And as soon as there's a relationship, then there's dependence, and then we're not talking about the unchanging, independent reality of Prajnaparamita. So Subhuti says, if we want to study Prajnaparamita, we should study it like studying empty space. Studying Prajna, premium knowing, is empty space. Empty space is studying premium knowing. Thomas Cleary has a little footnote in his, with his translation of this Dogen essay, where, like we've been talking about, he says, space-like mind is distinguished from the mind which is in space. So he's using mind, like two types of mind, big mind and small mind. Or maybe we could say, this morning we were talking about consciousness as an individual fifth skanda. I think consciousness is, in this sense of vijnana, is always used for an individual personal mind or kind of knowing, a subject-object kind of knowing. And you could say that kind of mind appears in, we could talk this way. I think this is what Thomas Cleary is, how he's envisioning this. That kind of mind appears in this bigger mind. It's a little funny to say that because then it sounds like there's one thing inside another, that there's individual consciousnesses in one kind of big mind of space. It's not really like there's things inside another thing. We can talk about this. And in fact, anything we can say is not quite right. But maybe more accurately, we'd say that that this individual consciousness of vijnana, it's just that its true nature already is big mind. The true nature of small mind is big mind, rather than one thing's inside another. See, slight difference there. I think he mentions things like meditation states, like the different dhyanas, concentration states and absorptions and realizations, that those are minds that appear within the space-like mind, he says. Then, we made it to page two. Then Indra asked the Buddha, world-honored one, if good men and good women receive, recite, reflect upon, and explain to others the profound Prajnaparamita you have explained, how should I, Indra, protect them? Please teach me. So first, Indra got this great teaching that Prajnaparamita is like space. And now Indra says, that's great. So if these good people, actually there's more terms than were translated here. In the Chinese, it says, this is actually comes from the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Actually, this is a Prajnaparamita Sutra being quoted, but it's often quoted like in the Diamond Sutra. That's the same list. Receive. This is what bodhisattvas can do with the sutra. They can receive it. They can maintain it. They can read it. They can recite it. And they can consider its principles, think about it, and expound it for others. That's the full list. It's being abbreviated here. Like in the Diamond Sutra, it keeps... people keep asking, well, if bodhisattvas receive this Diamond Sutra, if they maintain it, if they read it, if they recite it, if they consider its reasonings, and if they expound it for others, how much merit will there be? They ask that again and again. And of course, the Buddha says, this merit is inconceivable. Even if you were to heap up like piles of jewels higher than Mount Sumeru and give it all to the Buddha, that wouldn't compare with receiving and maintaining one verse of this Prajnaparamita Sutra. So it's a standard kind of part of the litany of these sutras. So now Indra's bringing up the list. If people like us receive this Prajnaparamita teaching, maintain it. I mean literally to like protect the book that you receive, or it might mean to practice it, then study it, read it, recite it or chant it, like we chant the Heart Sutra. Also think about it, consider its reasonings or its principles and expound it for others. This Prajnaparamita that you, Buddha, have explained, how should I protect those people? So Indra, the like emperor of the Deva realm, of the celestial beings, is kind of like a Dharmapala, like a Dharma protector. He actually listens to sutras and tries to practice, but these devas have these special powers. So they're like, I mean, the humans don't have many special powers. So the devas sometimes are like, these humans need some protection. So, and I'm into these Prajnaparamita sutras. So the humans that are into these sutras, how can I protect them? He's asking this. He's asking the Buddha, but then the Buddha is about to answer and Subhuti interrupts and answers for the Buddha. And he's like, this is going to be good. Let me do it, Buddha. And says,
I know this one, right?
Watch, check me out, Buddha. See if I get it right. Lord Indra, Kaushika, do you think there's anything you need to protect? Or maybe it could be translated, do you see anything that can be protected? In other words, any people, good men and women, that you're wondering how you can protect them? Can you find those people that need protection? And Indra takes a look, because I guess he didn't notice that beforehand, and says, no, great reverend, I don't see anything I need to protect, or I don't see anything that can be protected, because I don't see anybody actually, any truly existent people who are maintaining this Prajnaparamita. Well, it goes on. The conversation continues. So, because those poor people might have been like, oh, he was just about to protect us. And Subhuti got in the way, kind of refuted us. So Subhuti said, Lord Indra, Kaushika, if good men and women practice, this is the key point. If they practice, and this is now a different word than study. This is the word like sa, as in samu. Samu is work practice. So this means like to make or work or act or perform. So if good men and women work Prajnaparamita, if they practice it, the one the Buddha has explained, that itself is the protection. So all those good men and women who were disappointed that Indra wouldn't protect them now realize that if they themselves actually practice Prajnaparamita, that is their protection. And if they do so, if they practice it, they will not stray away from it or be separated from Prajnaparamita. So you should know that in case humans or non-humans wait for a way to harm good men and women, it will not be possible. Non-humans might be like demons that would come to harm these good men and women practicing Prajnaparamita. So Subhuti goes on, Lord Indra, Kaushika, protecting profound Prajnaparamita, which the Buddha has explained, and protecting all the bodhisattvas who practice it, are not different from protecting empty space. So first, Indra, who wants to protect the beings, hears and then discovers for himself that there he can't find any beings to protect. And then there's the further teaching of the beings that might start to feel like they could use some protection. Now they get the teaching that if they practice Prajnaparamita, they don't need protection because they can't be harmed. It won't be possible. So, of course, we could hear this as like the magical powers of practicing Prajnaparamita, but I don't think that's quite the point here, really. It's more that if one practices and realizes the emptiness of all things, including oneself and including the demons that try to harm one, then that is the protection from harm. You follow that? The true protection. And I think it's a great point, and it can apply to our life or anything that we're afraid of. We might say might be hard to do, but can we trust more and more deeply that the supreme protection from all harm and suffering is practicing and realizing. Practicing is realizing Prajnaparamita. Yes.
So I'm not taking it too literally, even like asking about demons, but wouldn't that mean that there's something inherent in Prajnaparamita that would counter whatever method of attack that something like a demon would inflict on humans? So if you're trying to think about it, I don't know. I guess maybe that's not something I should be thinking about too deeply.
I mean, that's one way to look at it, is that it's like almost like a magical amulet, kind of like force field for the Prajnaparamita protectors, is that they have an invisible force field. And when the demons come, they strike the force field and they're like, zzz, you know. But I think the reason Dogen's bringing this up as a practice point for us is that if we, the ones who are concerned about demons attacking us, deeply practice the profound Prajnaparamita, then we see that what we thought were demons are actually this empty space. What we think are demons are Prajnaparamita. We can't find any demons in addition to the knowing of demons. And the knowing of demons is, it's a particular manifestation of knowing, but knowing in itself is boundless, unchanging, and inherently, innately at peace and free from all suffering and harm. That's what supreme premium knowing of Prajnaparamita actually is. And then that this knowing that's always the same with each thought manifests a particular expression of this unchanging knowing, and each particular expression is different and changing. It seems to arise and cease. So we can think about a demon and our whole body tightens up. But then we see that actually the knowing of this image of demon and the knowing of the tightened body are in their deepest nature the unchanging, perfectly peaceful Prajnaparamita, bright empty space.
Yeah, you can almost even take it literally, because a demon could just be your own self-inflicted demon's habits.
Could be. I don't know if there's any other demons, according to Prajnaparamita, other than our.
What do I know?
I mean, it's not really that we individuals are the only one in the universe, but all demons are expressions of Prajnaparamita, this teaching would be saying, right? And their nature is equally Prajnaparamita, with all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas whose nature is Prajnaparamita. There's nothing whose true nature is not this, empty knowing space. Right? That's what, in that way, demons and Buddhas, have the same nature without the slightest variation. And practicing Prajnaparamita is opening to that possibility. And that's the possibility of no harm. And as I said this morning, it's true fearlessness is not dependent on like lengthening the lifespan of this body and mind. It's more like there might be particular manifestations that harm us or shorten our lifespan or something. But the true fearlessness that comes from this Prajnaparamita is ready to go through birth and death and these manifestations to benefit beings when deeply taking refuge in Prajnaparamita that can't be destroyed. That the true Prajnaparamita cannot be harmed. But this body, this appearing body can appear to be harmed, definitely. But I don't think that, this conversation is exactly on that level. I mean, it may be. That's more like the Prajna armor or something to protect this body. But I think that the deeper point is being made. These bodies will all, be gone soon. But Prajnaparamita, if we take refuge in it, is the supreme protection of ease and joy to birth and death. I says, quite a teaching to open to, I think. But I think this would be encouraged to. That's how I think Dogen's talking about it. The nature of mind is Prajnaparamita, and by the nature of mind, we mean its true nature, which is empty, boundless, unchanging, ungraspable, free and peaceful. That nature of mind is Prajnaparamita. And the nature of all things is the same as the nature of mind.
Somehow it brings up an experience I had in Japan where there was a Buddhist monk from some other Asian country and his wife. And they had a baby who died rather suddenly. And the wife was devastated. And the monk was just walking around very serenely. And that kind of split is, it doesn't feel right. Mm. Even if he was somehow extremely maybe involved with the Prajnaparamita. And you speak to that kind of disjointedness.
Mm. Yeah, so this is can you hear the questions on the screen? So the question is about if we're serenely immersed in Prajnaparamita and others around us are actually suffering due to the appearance of birth and death, which is the usual human thing, then it doesn't seem quite right to just go about it serenely, even if that was possible. Yeah, I think that's a great question. Sometimes it's said, the Bodhisattva Asanga said something like, the suffering with others is the greatest joy of Bodhisattvas. Something like this sounds very strange. In other words, like feeling the pain of others is what Bodhisattvas are really into. So I think this is, in a way, this is like the most profound question. I think this is how do we unite compassion and wisdom of emptiness without falling into either extreme? Another story that similar to this, but different than this, is on the track of this question is, I heard the story that D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen scholar and practitioner, he really did a lot of practice in Japanese Zen monasteries, as well as writing a lot of books. I heard the story that his wife died, and he was crying, and one of his students, that had this sort of one-sided idea about this, asked him, but you've realized emptiness, you've been practicing a long time, why are you crying? Almost like the opposite question. And D.T. Suzuki said, yeah, I'm crying, but my tears have no roots. Right? Something that kind of strikes me as he's really feeling the emotion. At the same time, maybe when somebody has to ask him to remind him, same time the tears are flowing, these tears have no roots. It's just like the appropriate response to what's happening. Of course there's crying, and that emotion. And that's the natural part for almost everyone. It's hard to imagine this monk who really wasn't affected. But what's not the case for everyone is to recognize that their tears have no roots. And then the trick seems, the difficulty is, how do we not fall into one side or the other? If it's just crying, then what's the point of Prajnaparamita? You know, if it's just wallowing in suffering, then that's what we've been doing. As the Buddha said, we've in these millions, infinite lifetimes, the tears we've shed in samsara would fill all the oceans of the world. And it's like, that's just how it is. And how can we work with this situation? So we either fall into that side and forget the rootlessness, or we get stuck in the rootlessness, which is sometimes called Zen sickness, stuck in the emptiness side, which is really, I think that when we say stuck in emptiness, I think it means stuck in a conceptual idea of emptiness. Because I think true emptiness is not sticky. And it includes everything, including tears. But we could get stuck in a kind of fear of suffering type of emptiness.
Yeah. Story, like, actually by Ram Dass, it was, made me think about this too, where it was about a monk who lost their child and was just inconsolable. And I think somebody like asked them similar thing of why they were crying, and they're like, well, or maybe he almost felt ashamed to the fact that he was totally out of control and inconsolable after losing his child, even though he knew that was something that he shouldn't be like hooked by that, or but that you have to go through a grieving process because like eventually it will become even more entrenched in you, and it'll take like instead of 2 years to grieve the loss of your child, 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, you know, if you just try and like put a band-aid over it, it festers, you know, and it becomes even worse where it gets you when you least expect it.
Yeah.
Like those emotions and the grieving process and all that still exists even within the emptiness. The point isn't that emotions aren't important necessarily or a part of our lives, right? It just means that they, you don't have to necessarily like completely, don't want to run from them and don't want to like attach to them and cling to them and hold on to them. And they're only as real as maybe you need them to be at the moment or something. Like, is it the ability to let it go? Is that what you mean by like the lack of roots? I guess I'm trying to understand that.
Maybe you could also see the lack of roots is like it's happening and it's fully it's functioning in this way. At the same time, there's some recognition that it's not, none of this is really the way I think it is, including the tears and me and the world and all of it. And I also think it's good to make a distinction between we call afflictive emotions, which are like, very self-centered, grasping and aversion, greed, hate, and delusion. And, other emotions that may not be afflictive, like grieving, I wouldn't consider an afflictive emotion. I think that's just a natural, even sadness. I mean, it could turn into getting really self-absorbed, but I think this natural response, if a loved one dies or something like this, it's just a natural interdependent, response and, not necessarily, I mean, some of the sticklers might say, there's some attachment, but maybe more just like a natural process. But, if we never go through the grieving or it's like, the grieving goes on forever, then maybe then it's starting to get too self, holding too much of a self or something. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Maybe that's what Ram Dass meant by festering. Mm-hmm. Turning into something ugly when it could have been dealt with in a way that was healthy.
Yeah.
If it was just accepted and sort of
yes.
Last Saturday, Reverend Nettie Mushenprek, Pointing Vine Center, gave a talk, and she talked about joy, and one of the things she talked about was objectless joy, which was like the joy of suffering with others. Mm-hmm. And if you want to listen to that talk, I thought it was good. And I just remember like after those kids were shot in Texas that morning, the next morning we all came to the Zendo and we sat and we were crying like before we sat. We did Zazen, we did the service, and then we were in the circle, and we bowed, and we all started crying again, and it was just really emotional, but it was great to just do that together as a Sangha, and to suffer, and to just feel the pain together, and then just go on. And yeah, and then go on.
The work of a bodhisattva is to match one's speed with another, like not walk too fast or walk too slow. So if someone's walking the speed of suffering, you walk that speed with them. And the walking, you know, speed of joy when you're with them. With that.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Kind of like harmonizing with the situation, being in accord with the situation. Yeah. According with the Indians. Mm-hmm. So, and when we're according with living beings like this and suffering along with others and enjoying along with others in profound Prajnaparamita, then there's nothing to protect, you could say, to protect ourselves. But we all, you know, we also don't need to protect ourselves against painful feelings. That would be maybe trying to, I don't know this person in your story, Jarreau, but like if maybe he was trying to protect his serenity or something in some maybe conscious or unconscious way. If there's nothing to protect, then you could just cry. Yeah. And then Sir Dogen says, thus know that receiving, reciting, or reflecting upon profound Prajnaparamita is no other than protecting Prajna. The wish or intention to protect is receiving, reciting, and so forth. Going along with what's happening is a kind of protection of Prajna, you could say too. And that's what this next poem of Ru Jin is about. And I think we can get into it more tomorrow, but just to, I think it's a real highlight of this essay, this poem of Dogen's teacher. Ru Jin, my late master, old Buddha, said, the entire body is a mouth hanging in empty space. Regardless of the wind from east, west, south, or north, or literally it says like, without questioning whether the wind comes from east, west, south, or north, joining the whole universe in chiming out Prajna, or literally, it equally speaks Prajna for others. Ding, 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 ding. So in this way, being like Prajnaparamita is like a wind bell whose round mouth is so big that it fills all of space, or that there's no bell in addition to the empty mouth of the bell, empty mouth circle of the bell, and sound comes forth from this empty mouth of the bell. Right? So the entire body is the poem is called Wind Bell, so we know that that's the mouth that is being talked about. The entire body is this empty mouth hanging in empty space, and it doesn't care whether the wind comes from this painful situation or this birth and death, or this great joy, or whatever. All these winds are coming in all directions, painful and pleasant winds. And the this mouth that's hanging in empty space receives all the winds. It doesn't It doesn't pick and choose among the winds. And it speaks prajna, but the speaking of prajna isn't like generated by itself. It's generated by these winds, right, that come from all the directions. Just move this this mouth hanging in empty space. They knock it around. They shove it this way and that. And the mouth doesn't mind. Without even trying to figure out where the winds are coming from, it just lets the sound come forth, equally expressing prajna for others. And it sounds like ding, 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 ding. Actually, in there's different comment, like Ujiyama Roshi's like, I asked, my Chinese friend, how these characters are pronounced, because they're onomatopoeia. And he said it sounds like this, but other people, there's other Dogen commentaries say it sounds like this. They were getting into like, what exactly is, how do you translate ting ting? But it looks like the Mandarin contemporary pronunciations, di ding dong, di ding dong. But we don't care. whether it sounds like di ding dong or bong or meow, whatever comes out is fine, because it's just like it's a mouth hanging in empty space. It's willing to let anything come out. I think it's a great poem. Dogen was really into this poem. Tomorrow I'll tell you the story of Dogen getting like freaking out in his ecstasy just hearing this poem. Anything else? No. Anything from Zoom land? Like, this is the question, right? How can we fully realize prajna, paramita, like empty space where nothing's arising and ceasing, and trust that deeply, respectfully venerate that understanding, take refuge in that freedom, and at the same time, live in this world, walking the same speed as those around us, and according with living beings, lifetime after lifetime, with no other purpose, really, as bodhisattvas have no other purpose than just according like this while expounding prajnaparamita. They can sound like anything. And the expounding of prajnaparamita will sound different if the wind comes from the west or the east. Sometimes it sounds like moo. Sometimes it sounds like sometimes the wind doesn't blow. And in that case, the bell, the mouth hanging in space, doesn't go looking for some wind. It just gets to rest very joyfully. And it doesn't feel guilty that it's not making any sound at that time. And but it's also ready. Hello?
Can I hear a very quick story? What, talking about the windmill, I used some bamboo wind chimes for my deck. You know, on Amazon, they have comments from consumers, and there was one that was concerned that he was going to get mechanical windmill.
You're for some reason your progeny is like scattered and all. Getting a weird sound.
Oh,
it's the wind is just going crazy. But you have the, it sounds like I got the point that there's a wind bell hanging right near you, and it's ringing. Oh yes, that's collect the cups. Yeah. Is that right?
Should I try it again? Can you hear me now? Oh no, I bought some wind chimes, some bamboo wind chimes recently from Amazon. And am I coming through?
Yes. Can y'all hear?
And you know the comments from the.
You didn't know that the wind bell comes from Amazon.
Comes from Amazon.
Okay.
And there was a consumer who was upset. I guess maybe there wasn't enough wind, and his chimes were not making sound, so he was wondering if he could get a mechanical wind chime.
Thank you. Yeah, that consumer could just wait and sit zazen while waiting for the wind. It'll come. It'll come. Sooner or later, the good wind, the bad wind, and the eight winds of the world will blow that mouth all over the place. So, now we can sit in and wait for the wind. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.